This is Bronwyn Schwagert, licensed therapist and author at the Angry at the Right Things podcast. Instead of controlling our anger, we'll be looking at what causes it in the first place so we can rectify what's dysfunctional in our lives and in the world. Here we go. Everyone, this is Bronwyn Schwagert, and I'm here with my bestie Katie Wander.
Hello.
We're trying to figure out the mic situation here. So today it's going to be a lot of me talking, and I definitely have an agenda today. It's something I've been wanting to share for a long time, actually. It's kind of an essay of sorts that I have written about motherhood, and I'm excited to share it. It's what I've been calling my pièce de résistance, because this has been kind of forming and fomenting in my mind for a long time, many years, actually, if I'm going to be honest. And so it's still a work in progress, but I have not yet shared it with Katie. So this is going to be the first time she hears what I have written out in this essay. And I want to hear what she has to say. And I also want to encourage you as a listener, even if you're not a mother and never wanting to be or ever being a parent, you have a mother and you're also a human. And if you're a human, you definitely have a mother, right?
Yes.
So I think this will help make a lot of sense for you. I think this is kind of like a diamond that has a lot of facets to it if you really take the time to look. So this is my goal, is to help all of us understand ourselves, really, but especially mothers, and also to be an inspiration and encouragement. And it might seem a little, what's the word, challenging to hear at first, but I think you'll see near the end that it's actually much more of an encouragement and inspirational than challenging.
All right. I'm excited.
Are you all ears?
I am all ears.
Okay. So this is called Dear Mother. When you become a mother, you may suddenly feel more vulnerable than you've ever felt. You may feel not only exhausted from continually nurturing another little human, but resentful that no one is nurturing or adequately nurturing you. You may feel more alone than you've ever felt. You may have desired to become a mother so you'd never have to feel alone and to have someone to love you unconditionally. And now that someone is here, you've never felt so unloved and unseen. Maybe you thought motherhood would complete or fulfill you, and you have never felt so empty and depleted. Maybe it's disappointing as hell. Here's the thing. A child at any age will never be a reflection of our worth or value. Instead of mirroring back to you how thankful she is for the round-the-clock care and sacrifice, she's a black hole, only letting you know what you haven't done right or where you're still failing her somehow. Sure, you might see a smile or a laugh here and there, and that feels like heaven, but it's only an oasis in a parched wilderness of sand. All you can do is wait and hope for another, and it's out of your control. Black holes don't reflect anything back, not even if we were to do it perfectly, as if that were possible. We do not see a reflection of our sacrifices, but rather an endless horizon of even more sacrifices to come. Maybe you dream that someday that reflection will arrive, like when she gets all A's on her report card and makes you proud, or when she fulfills the dreams you have never pursued for yourself, or when she looks beautiful and happy with you in social media posts. Maybe you long for the day she becomes your little best friend and you're never lonely again. Dear mother, those things might indeed come to pass, but I'm here to tell you that would be the worst of all possible outcomes for her. Dear mother, please know that she needs to always be a black hole to you and you alone. Please know she's never supposed to reflect you back to you. No, dear woman, the day you became a mother, you became a nurturer whose job is to remain only a nurturer, not a recipient of any nurture or reward, at least not from your child. Motherhood has been called a thankless job, and I'm here to tell you that is true if you do it right. If you do it right, you can accept this little ball of chaos and disorder for what it is and know that its potential is there, still unseen, but it's your job to reflect that potential into reality. It's your job to be the mirror, not hers. That requires patience, not expecting more order than there is at each moment in time. That requires being okay with the chaos and knowing your role is to see more than what your eyes take in. You see, dear mother, you need to see with your heart and imagination and not be deceived by your senses. You need to trust that all your nurture efforts are taking root, even if you don't see any fruit or even a sprout of evidence. In order to mirror her correctly, you can't trust what you see for a moment. It's a thankless job of constant giving. It's tiresome and lonely, but if you see with your heart, disregarding your other senses, you will find a treasure never found elsewhere. You will find delight like you've never found when you are least seeking it. You will find a delight that has nothing to do with you, and you can lose yourself in it. When you've surrendered all your expectations and longings for fulfillment on your own terms, you will find this delight in her. If you can disregard yourself, including the messes she makes for you to clean up or the many inconveniences she creates for you, you can allow yourself to be swept up in sheer delight by this creature you see before you. This delightful creature that you didn't create, but to whom you played a vital, supportive role. You see, witnessing her discoveries, her mastery over her own body and the objects around her, or her little brain at work taking it all in and making sense of things, is pure miracle. And dear mother, it's made to delight you. It's the performance of a lifetime, and you get a front row seat. She needs you to be her audience, cheering her on with a look of marvel and amazement. That's how it's designed to work. She delights you, and you mirror her, reflecting her back her worth and her importance. She learns how powerful she is to you, and she takes that in and never forgets it. That, dear mother, is the power you have, the power to give her lifelong feelings of importance and value, and that's all it takes, which is everything. How do you do this when she is older, you ask? You listen as if your life depended on it. Without judgment, without advice, you listen to her words with the intent to understand her, to really understand her, and simultaneously help her to understand herself. When you're able to give her this gift of regular, unconditional listening and understanding, you're able to notice patterns and reflect those back to her. Like, do you notice you seem to get triggered when you skip meals? Or I'm wondering if you're feeling this way right now based on how you felt the last time this happened to you. This is what a good therapist does. And dear mother, how much more does your child want to be seen and understood by you than a paid professional? Over time, your child learns to self-reflect and to see herself clearly when she is mirrored by you. you're not managing her behaviors, but helping her see why she behaves like she does in the first place. You're empowering her and giving her lifelong wisdom like nothing else. Your consistent presence mirrors to her that even when she behaves horribly, she's still loved and thus lovable. Your unconditional commitment to not reject her gives her the courage to take risks because she knows that even her failures don't define her worth. Your presence is invitational. It's an ongoing invitation to take the risk towards growth and engage a learning curve fraught with failure and mistakes. This is a risk most people spend their lives avoiding. All this gives your child the impression or the permission to be simply human, accepting the good, bad, and ugly within herself. She learns that's all that is expected of her, and it's not shameful. This enables her to be her authentic self, and when someone rejects her humanity, she's able to discern when it is clearly their problem and not hers. You see, dear mother, your job is to create the environment necessary for her flourishing. Just as a bud remains a bud until it feels the warmth and light and safety needed to blossom, your child is no different. When you nurture her in this way, she will delight you and all the world as she blooms radiantly for all to see. And how desperately the world needs for her to flower. Good news, your power to create this environment for her never fades. All right. That was a lot. That was dense.
that dense is the right word. Right. So I'm going to start at the end with what you said about your power never fading. Mm-hmm. So when you say that, do you mean like even if you've maybe really stumbled and failed up to this point, you could still turn things around?
Yes, which is the second half. The second half is about.
Okay.
Well, that tells me that I'm stringing you along well with my essay.
That's the cliffhanger. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Got it.
I
like that. That's really good because what you had to say is dense and could definitely cause someone to despair a little bit because it's like, the ways I have gone wrong, you know? Yeah. So, and that's speaking as someone not with small children, but with nearly grown children. Mm-hmm. It's hopeful to think that you could always do better tomorrow.
We've referred to this before, the Maya Angelou.
When you know better, do better. What's it? Something like that.
Yeah, I want to look it up because
do is what I don't,
Maya Angelou.
I can't remember it, but Maya, it's very good.
Angelou quotes. Here's her quotes. Okay. Everyone loves Maya Angelou's quotes. All right, quotes. She has a lot. Which ones are the best according to? That's funny. There's so many. Okay, let me see. Okay, here it is. Do the best you can until you know better. Then when you know better, do better.
Yeah.
So simple, but profound.
Really profound, right? Like one of those head slappers kind of, you know, like I need to remember this every day.
So should I keep going then or do you have more reflections?
Oh.
Should I keep going? Because I don't want to leave you and everyone else.
Yeah, no, go for it. Okay. I'm dying to hear what comes next.
Okay. So this next part This is the transition. Gets a little personal now.
Okay.
Dear mother, do the hard thing. Don't pretend. Make good on your failures. That's what this one's titled. When I was 40, our family was uprooted and relocated in a city only a couple of hours away, but it felt more like the other side of the moon, the dark, cold, empty side.
Yeah.
I fell into a depressive episode, the likes of which I never dreamt or imagined possible. I unraveled. I wilted. I wasn't myself. I lost myself. I became physically ill, involuntarily vomiting at random times, such as walking down the street or driving on the freeway.
Oh.
And I gained about 30 pounds in like 2 or 3 months. It was hell on earth, a solitary, lonely hell. In the midst of my suffering, my worried husband reached out to my parents for help. I didn't speak to them firsthand at the time, but he did. He told me my mom seemed to somehow understand my reaction to this move might be related to the childhood move our family made when I was 10.
Oh.
When we relocated from the warmth of my grandfather's presence in Ohio to the cold beauty of California, where he was not. My mom told my husband with a tone of remorse, I know her father and I weren't really there for Bronwyn when we moved to California. As much of an understatement as it was surely an admission of wrongdoing tinged with regret. It was a peek behind a curtain I'd never seen, and it was promising. I had no idea my mom was aware of how her emotional neglect around and after our move harmed me. In fact, it caused me to have nervous breakdowns in middle school and develop a mild version of borderline personality disorder in which friends rejected me because I was far too demanding of their exclusive attention and presence. Then I became quite literally obsessed with boys when I was finally attractive enough to catch them, as we've discussed.
Right.
My parents paid my husband and I a concerned visit at this time. So now I'm back to 40 years old again.
Okay.
And they saw me suffering. They saw me being not me. They saw a new version of me, one that didn't engage or even make eye contact, but whose head was bowed down. At one point, my mom felt so grieved, she was compelled to do something. And so she started massaging my foot.
Right, right.
She never made eye contact with me or told me how sorry she was to see me so broken. But what she really didn't do and what 40-year-old depressed me needed her to do was look me in the eyes and show her concern and tell me how sorry she was for abandoning me the first time this happened 30 years before. If she'd done that, the tears stuck inside me would have finally been released from their lifelong dam, and she could have held me while I cried, and I would have let her. I would have experienced catharsis. That would have led to the undoing of my depressive episode and the simultaneous remaking of my faith in her. It would have been so nice. But none of that happened, and I felt more alone than ever, and I asked my parents to please leave. You see, sometimes it's more lonely in the presence of others than by yourself, especially when those others are supposed to know you and see you and attune to you, and they won't. Over a decade later now, my mom is gone, and as myself being a seasoned psychotherapist, I see the lost potential for paradise at that moment. You see, dear mothers, it's never too late to own your mistakes, and the mistakes are never too big to acknowledge. You have more power than you know, and it doesn't diminish over time, even when your children are as old as me. You see, dear mothers, an apology is truly a resurrection and a pivot to start over. Don't stay dead another moment. Don't allow fear to prevent your metamorphosis. Don't allow shame to steal another single moment of your life. Take it from me. It's not worth the risk, or it is worth the risk. As tragic as this part of the story is, like everything, it's bittersweet. You see, when I lost myself to depression at age 40, my daughter was 6 and she was emotionally abandoned by me. I did to her something akin to what my mother had done to me, and I had no idea. After I rejected her, after she was emotionally abandoned by me, and I didn't know that, all I knew is what I felt, which was rejected by a daughter who seemed to no longer want to be around me. On top of my depression, I felt unwanted by my daughter. The sweet little girl who had always loved being with me was now calling me a bad mommy, and I had no idea why. All I felt were my feelings. All I knew was my pain, not hers. As my daughter grew older, she'd call me a narcissist and tell me I was just like my mother. She knew exactly how to hurt me, because the truth hurts, doesn't it?
Yeah.
As I started waking up from the depression, which came and went over the course of many years, and I was able to achieve a new level of objectivity on these types of things as a professional therapist, I saw what happened with new eyes. I saw that I had failed my daughter just like I had been failed by my mother. I realized what was needed was more than an apology, but a commitment to do the long, patient work to earn back her trust. So I did. I apologized not only for what I did when she was little, but for all the micro abandonments I'd done since by making it all about my feelings, neglecting hers. At age 19, I confessed that I'm triggered by feelings of rejection, and that's a me problem, not hers. And I apologized for putting it onto her for her entire life. I took ownership for how ugly I'd been, all the times I felt rejected by her, and the rage I displayed at her expense. I told her she's free to reject me as much as she needs to from here on out, because I'm not going anywhere anymore. I became a listener, not a talker, in our conversations. I stopped demanding she answer my questions about her life and her thoughts. And I allowed her to open up with me if and when she wanted, as much or little as she wanted. I stopped giving her my sage advice unless she asked, which, funny thing, she never did. I learned to tolerate the awkward silences when she chose not to talk, because even though it's uncomfortable for me, it's not for her. In fact, I'm still learning. Isn't that all anyone can do? You see, life is a learn by doing kind of experience, and we're not born seasoned humans, but it's paying off for both of us. I'm learning to delight in something I was unable to see for many, many years, and she's learning to blossom in spite of my mistakes. The great thinker Marcel Proust, we quoted him last session, last episode, once wrote, "We don't receive wisdom. We must discover it for ourselves after a journey that no one can take for us or spare us." You see, my daughter and I are both learning how to be human. And we're learning it's a shared experience.
So that's the conclusion?
So far.
So far. Okay. To be continued. Somehow I feel like there's going to be a part three.
Yeah.
That's great. That makes me feel, like I said, after the first part, it makes me feel hopeful, because it's making me think about, I really like what you had to say about it never being too late. Not only to not apologize, but then to make the real effort to change. Mm-hmm. And I think that is kind of everything, sort of like with not just parent relationships, mm-hmm. but relationships with mm-hmm. everyone in your life. Like that's the ultimate human thing. Mm-hmm. Like, but the parenting is the most profound and
yeah. Well,
personal.
Yeah. I'm glad you caught that. Cause that's when I said this has many facets.
Yeah.
This is for everyone. Oh, this is for all relationships.
I see it. Yeah. And I feel it, and it, I have some relationships or lost relationships in my life that I have felt pretty hopeless about, but this makes me think that maybe there's something there that I could change. And it makes me think about my own parenting mistakes and how I have been trying to do better and continue and hopefully will do more and do better on and on forever. I mean, as long as I'm still a mother.
Can I ask if anything came to the surface for you about when you were listening to this about what you want to do better, what you want to kind of.
Oh gosh. Like, as a parent. Yeah. I think the listening, mm-hmm. listening, but not pushing, like not, and that's something I've been working on. Not trying to pry or force my kids to tell me things, to try to give them their privacy and their mm-hmm. space to be mm-hmm. who they are and make their mistakes. Not try to, I think I err on the side of trying to control things too much for them out of a desire to protect them from pain and suffering, but that's not really helping them. So, kind of learning to let go, I would say.
Yeah. How does that Marcel Proust quote help when you think of them, that we can't receive wisdom, which means we can't give anyone else wisdom either.
Right.
We must all discover it like for ourselves.
We can try. Right. I mean, we can try so much to like share our wisdom from our life experiences with our kids, which in my experience, they tend to be pretty resistant to.
Yeah.
But we are just trying. It's like, I'm trying to save you this suffering because I've done it. And I know that that was, you know, fool's errand, don't do it, you know, but they kind of have to learn it. They have to learn it for themselves. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And just reminding myself of that, to not be, and to, I think I also have a tendency to feel responsible for other people's emotions. Mm-hmm. And that kind of falls into the same thing of trying to protect other people from pain. But all I'm really doing is kind of making myself sick when I do that. Mm-hmm. And then I'm can't be good at being there for them in the way that they would benefit from, which is listening and being present. Mm-hmm. But like in a healthy way, so that they have the freedom to be who they are.
Yeah, I think the dynamic you're describing describes so many parents and friends and, you know, everyone.
Yeah.
But especially with your kids, if you feel responsible for them.
Yes.
Not to them, but for them, as in their feelings. Then you're going to try to shield them from pain.
Oh, yeah.
And we've talked about here, but it's worth revisiting, that pain isn't all bad.
No.
Right?
Avoidance of pain is it's natural, I think, to want to avoid pain. Mm. But ultimately, it's counterproductive, I think.
Yeah, right. So, if we could see every challenge – every bit of suffering in life as a double-edged sword that yes, it wounds, but it's also necessary for wisdom, for right. It's an opportunity. Right. It's not just suffering. It is an opportunity and to grow up.
Right. It reminds me of a quote I heard from this author once, and I cannot recall his name, but he had said something about teaching. He was also, I want to say, a basketball coach, this writer, and he was explaining how you learn from your failures.
Yeah.
He was talking about with athletes, but he was also talking about with life. Like, you don't really learn anything when you win.
You don't. That's so true.
You don't. I mean, it feels fantastic,
right?
But you don't really learn anything.
But then you're like compelled to only win to maintain that.
And right. Like, to maintain that high, right? But when you lose, when you fail, when you stumble, those are the things that you learn from.
Yeah.
And so as painful as they are in the moment, those are those things that the lessons that stick with you.
And what's interesting, you saying this, as a parent, we can help our kids learn because we can just be that sounding board for them to reflect and process things and not be alone in the pain.
Because
remember, if from when things are painful, when we're suffering, pain in isolation is unbearable. But when it's shared with someone who can empathize and validate us and has that level of objectivity to empathize and validate us, and we don't feel alone in the pain, now it's like it's dissipated. It's all better. And now we can process and go, well, I actually kind of see why that happened. You know, we can process it. We can kind of think out loud, and we need a sounding board. So a parent has the ideal job, if the relationship is good, to be that person to help our kids, instead of suffering being all bad, for it to be A, relieved and comforted, and B, processed where it is an opportunity to grow and learn and do better.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
But that takes a level of objectivity. We can't shield, we can't be afraid
of
failure or mistakes.
And if we are not, if we have a lot of unprocessed anger and grief, we might not be very objective, I think.
Oh.
Because we're kind of stuck in our own suffering, maybe, I wonder. And so it makes
harder. Would that be something that would cause a guilt knot?
I think so.
So if we have a guilt knot, because so Katie and I have talked about, some people have guilt knots and some people have shame knots. And I think I've lifelong had a shame knot that's now unraveled, and Katie has struggled with a guilt knot.
Yes.
And when you have a guilt knot as a mother or as a parent, you do, I think, naturally, that guilt makes you want to shield your kids from all pain.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
I see.
I think especially I have a child that has a disability, and so I think I'm extra protective. Mm-hmm. I've always been extra protective. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I mean, that's not an excuse. It's just I think it's just all the more the guilt is all the worse. The knot is all the tighter, right? Mm-hmm. So it takes more work to let it go.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell me about what that guilt, how that works. Can you break it down for me? Because I don't understand guilt knots firsthand. I see them, but I'm more of a shame knot kind of girl.
Gosh. I don't know. We might have to talk about that next time, because I think I'm going to have to think about it, because I know that I feel it.
You feel guilty, but it makes you want to shield her from suffering.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And same with my son too. Mm-hmm. Not to the same degree, but and I think it's also kind of something I learned.
That you witnessed? Or?
I don't know if I witnessed it. I know that I didn't.
Mm. Oh, I know.
I didn't have a lot of.
I know.
Yeah.
Because when you were three.
Yeah.
Your mom had your baby sister, and she was not, your mom was not in a good place.
Right.
With her marriage, with her life, everything. And you became a burden.
Yes.
Implicitly, you felt like it. She didn't intentionally want you to feel that way, but that's how little Katie felt.
Right.
And people who grow up, for whatever reason, feeling like they're a burden, feel guilt knots the rest of their lives. Yes. And they don't want to burden others.
No.
And they want to shield others from pain.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So
that makes sense.
It's like very ingrained in me.
Yeah.
And I'm like just now like working on recognizing it. And
people with guilt knots have the hardest time asking for help.
Oh, yeah. Almost impossible. To be avoided at all costs. Yeah. Yeah.
What? And tell me about that. Like,
I don't know. I don't know how to explain it, but it's true.
Because do you imagine, like, let's say you were to reach out to me, you were struggling with something, would you feel like you're burdening me at some level?
Yeah. Being a bummer or something. Like being a burden, being depressing, you know, fixating on the negative. And there's people that aren't very tolerant of that. You're not one of those people, but yeah.
Yeah. I think I know who that might person was for you, Katie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Okay. So Katie has a guilt, still is unraveling, in the process of unraveling her guilt knot.
Yes.
And we use the word knot because I read a quote a few months ago and it talked about how lies entangle. And that's when I was like, oh, they make knots. Mm-hmm. And some people have shame knots and some people have guilt knots.
Yes. I think that's just so profound of you.
Well,
to figure that out. Like, yeah. Because when I look at the people I know, I feel like almost everyone falls into one of those categories.
I think that's right? True.
Yeah. You know, it's like, what is your dominant horrible emotion that like
guilt or shame?
Yeah. Guilt or shame.
Yes.
It's not usually both. It's usually one or the other.
Yes. Well, I think those of us with shame knots grew up, as you guys now all know, with histories of profound abandonment feelings.
Yes.
From a parent or both parents.
Yes.
And so we have shame because what happens when a kid feels rejected or abandoned by their parents is they of course believe they're shameful, that it's them.
Yes.
That they are inherently flawed and bad. And then the kids who grew up feeling like a burden have guilt knots because they just inherently feel bad for existing and for having feelings and needs and limits. And that's just kind of, it's a template.
Yeah.
It's a little template in our little brains. That doesn't go away.
No.
Unless we acknowledge it consciously and challenge it and unravel it.
And maybe even like constantly. Like it's something I think, not constantly, but I think it's something you have to work on. I mean.
Well, my shame knot, I had unraveled a couple years ago. Did I ever tell you the story?
I don't think so.
I mean, okay, so granted I'm a therapist and so I have all these kind of thoughts always in the back of my head kind of fomenting.
Yeah.
And I was out for a run one day. We talked about how like outside, when we're outside, especially our minds kind of meditate or not meditate, reflect and introspect. And so I was out for a run one day and I was just kind of processing a lot of things about my father and all the shame that I felt from him in particular. And while I was running, I was like, I'm going to put all my shame in a big cardboard box. And I'm going to imagine myself giving that box to him and saying, here you go. Return to owner. This is yours. This isn't my shame. I'm realizing it never was. It's yours. Here you go. And just walking away. And I imagine that while I was running. And Katie, something absolutely flipped for me. Like,
that's amazing.
It was like that, you know, that slow in a way, but then that quick.
It was like you'd been carrying this thing around.
Everything shifted.
Yeah.
Oh.
And you just put it down.
Everything shifted when I did that exercise for myself.
Yeah. That's awesome.
So that's why when I work with my clients, I do a lot of imagery work because it is powerful.
Yeah.
So I think going back to the root of where that burden, where you started feeling like a burden, like with your mom when you were three, is really imperative. And what little Katie learned at age three, she learned that she's too much, that her asking for help, her having needs, her being sad or crying, God forbid, was just burdensome. And so she can't do that. She can't share that, her feelings and needs, with anyone else.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's too, like, inconvenient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So she learned to be self-contained.
Self-contained, quiet, mm-hmm. don't rock the boat. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you see that played out with your children. It's hard to witness them be angry, be sad, have feelings, have needs, that kind of
yeah,
thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, not so much the everyday things, but the bigger kind of disappointment feelings. I think mm-hmm. especially with teenagers, there's mm-hmm. a lot of emotional mm-hmm. ups and downs, mm-hmm. disappointments. Friendship becomes really important. Mm-hmm. And the lack of friendship mm-hmm. can be really painful, mm-hmm. like you were talking about. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what is little Katie, when she's a mother of two teens, need to be reminded from adult Katie when she sees them struggle and wants to shield them from it?
Yeah, kind of like I'm sort of seeing this thing in my mind of like standing there and watching, but not like like being there but not interfering. Kind of like being present and available but not interfering. That's what I'm seeing in my mind. Like, it's very important to be there and to not just physically to be there, to not be checked out, like emotionally.
To be available. But not intrusive or not.
No. Okay. And not available in the sense that at anyone's beck and call, but available when it matters, when it's important. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. That it's okay for them to struggle.
Yeah. And
That doesn't make her a failure.
Right, right. And that they won't, you know, they'll be okay. Mm-hmm. Like, they're just, because if they fail, they'll be okay. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
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 Okay, well, we've covered a lot of ground today, going from motherhood to our personal situations where we're at.
Yeah.
Any other reflections?
I don't think so. No, I think I need to think about what you said about the guilt knot. Mm-hmm. Like, how does that really, like, play out and, like, affect? It's almost like it has tendrils.
Yes.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I need to think about that.
It's where it shows up.
Oh, yeah.
Where those tendrils.
It's all over.
Yeah.
It's all over my life, not just with my kids, but
I think just in conclusion, I want to say the most important thing for all of us as parents, as friends, as humans, with all of our relationships with the divine, with Mother Earth, with whoever, with whatever, is our relationship with ourselves.
Right.
And we will, by default, parent our young selves exactly like our parents parented us, which is to dismiss their feelings or to shame them or pretend we're burden or, you know, act like they're burdensome or even gaslight them. We'll do that to ourselves if we don't intentionally consciously see it
yes
and stop it and start to attune to our young selves by attuning to our young selves' feelings and needs and allowing ourselves to have limits and making those things a priority and healing that relationship with ourselves, not abandoning ourselves.
Yeah.
Not betraying ourselves anymore. And once that is restored, it's like magic. Everything else kind of just falls into place much more easily. I think
you're so right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was thinking of another thing that this is something I heard on a television show. And it's something people kind of make fun of as a cliche, but I think there's a lot of truth to it about parenting and how you have to put on your own. You know how on the airplane, mm-hmm. the gas mask, whatever, and they say, or not gas mask. What are they called? They should be gas masks, but
oxygen mask.
Yeah. Thank you. How you have to put your own oxygen mask on first.
Yeah.
And in, you know, that could be taken as, I think people kind of say that like, oh yes, like self-care. I have to like put me first, like in this kind of icky way.
Yeah.
Like, but no, that's not what I mean. I mean, if you're not right with yourself, then you can't do a good job.
Like, yeah.
If you're not right with yourself and your young self and you haven't like looked at this, looked at it and seen it and faced it, you can't really be the best parent to your kids.
That's exactly right. I'm really glad you brought that up because when I hear people say, I got to put myself first, why does anyone have to be first? That implies someone's going to be last.
Right.
Like, let's just do away with that whole statement.
Yeah.
I'm talking about a relationship with our young child, inner child, one of attunement, of connection, that's not shaming, that's not, you know, betraying, that is where we're caring for ourselves and not betraying and neglecting ourselves anymore. That is not self-care. I mean, I guess you could call it that.
Yeah.
But I really don't even like that term.
No.
It's self-attunement. It's self-nurture.
Yes.
And that might look different at different phases in our lives, at different times, in different places, for different people.
Yeah.
But that's really about, you know, And it also means we have to be aware of ourselves, and we have to know what our young inner child is struggling with. Like, when she feels ashamed, when she feels angry, and we have to attune to it and allow it and validate those feelings. And our feelings tell us our needs. So I'm quoting, by the way, from How We Love, one of my favorite therapy books by Kay and Milan Yurkovich. But they talk about our feelings tell us our needs. So when we attune to our young selves, it starts with, hey, little Bronwyn, what are you feeling right now? You're feeling angry because someone just, you know, ditched you? Okay. Yeah. Absolutely. You get to be angry. Who wouldn't be angry? So we start there with what is she feeling? Of course you feel that. We validate it. We attune to it. And then if you're feeling this angry, what do you need from me, adult Bronwyn, right now?
Right.
You need a boundary with that person. You need to write a fantasy letter out right now. Do you need to tell Katie how angry you are? You know, what do you need?
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about self-care,
putting
ourselves first. I don't like those terms.
No.
Yeah. So thank you.
Yeah. No, I like that. Yeah, that's huge.
And I honestly am to the point where I think our relationship with our young child selves is really our relationship with anger.
Yeah. That makes sense.
It is.
Doesn't it? Because children feel powerless generally, right? So what do they do with their anger?
Yes. So guys, wherever your anger is showing up for you, we'll talk more about this, but I absolutely am convinced that my anger is why I had insomnia for years, decades.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Decades.
I didn't know that you – I thought you still suffered from that.
So no, it's gone.
It's incredible.
Oh, I sleep like a baby.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, guys, my insomnia was so bad. I was actually hospitalized at one point. My daughter drove me to the ER because I couldn't drive myself because I hadn't slept for 3 nights straight at all. I was like going into I don't want to say psychosis, but anyway, I don't want to say that. But I was starting to like
lack
lose
of
it.
Sleep will take you there.
Yeah. And if you have chronic insomnia, I think your younger child, your little child, is really angry. And she's not just angry at whoever hurt you. She's angry at you because you're not listening to her.
Yeah.
You're not letting her speak.
Angry at yourself.
You're betraying her.
Yeah.
And she's showing up for you. She's trying to communicate that by your insomnia. Now, a lot of people, you and I spoke about this. I've never had migraines or major headaches, and you haven't either.
No.
But a lot of my clients do. And I'm realizing that is their inner child telling them how angry she is at them for not listening to her anger.
Right.
So I am convinced that a lot of us who have insomnia, migraines, or some kind of like chronic pain that has no medical reason, I think it's that we're betraying ourselves and we're not listening to our inner child who's angry.
That makes so much sense. Yeah.
So let's wrap it up for today. But we covered a lot. And Katie, thank you so much for listening and reflecting and sharing about yourself.
Yeah. Thank you for your words of wisdom. I really enjoyed your essay.
Thank you. Well, I'm 52 and I've suffered a lot. So there we go. All right. Bye, y'all.